A Vindication of the Rights of Woman by Mary Wollstonecraft. First published in 1792. First part of Chapter 3. Continuing the discussion of the prevailing opinion about sexual differences. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Bodily strength, once the distinction of heroes, has sunk into such undeserved contempt that men as well as women seem to think it unnecessary. Women, because it detracts from their feminine graces and from that lovely weakness that is the source of their undue power, and men, because it seems to conflict with the character of a gentleman. It won't be hard to prove that the two sexes have both departed from one extreme and run into another. But before I come to that, I should perhaps observe that a certain common error has come to have some acceptance, and this has given strength to a false conclusion in which an effect has been mistaken for a cause. People of genius have very often impaired their constitutions by study, or by careless inattention to their health, and superficial observers have inferred from this that men of genius have commonly weak, or to use a more fashionable term, delicate, constitutions. But the truth is the opposite of that, I believe. Diligent inquiry has led me to the conclusion that strength of mind has in most cases been accompanied by superior strength of body. Natural soundness of constitution, I mean, not the robust tone of nerves and vigour of muscles that come from bodily labour when the mind is at work only in directing the hands. Dr. Priestley has remarked that the majority of great men have lived beyond the age of 45. Now, think about a great scientist who carelessly lavishes his strength when investigating his favourite science, wasting the lamp of life, forgetful of the midnight hour. Or think about a poet lost in dreams that his imagination has peopled, and his soul disturbed by the passions that his meditation has raised, until it shakes his constitution, passions whose purely imaginary objects fade before his exhausted eye. They must have had iron constitutions. Shakespeare himself didn't grasp the airy dagger with a nerveless hand, and Milton didn't tremble when he led Satan far from the confines of his dreary prison. These were not the ravings of imbecility, the sickly effusions of unwell brains, but the exuberance of an imagination that wasn't continually reminded of its material shackles when it was wandering in a fine frenzy. I am aware that this argument would carry me further than you may think I want to go, but I follow truth, and still adhering to my first position, I will admit that bodily strength seems to give man a natural superiority over woman. And this is the only solid basis on which the superiority of the sex can be built. But I still insist that not only the virtue, but also the knowledge of the two sexes should be the same in nature, if not in degree, and that women, considered not only as moral but as rational creatures, should try to acquire human virtues or perfections by the same means as men, instead of being educated like a fanciful kind of half-being, one of Rousseau's wild inventions. But if bodily strength is, with some show of reason, something men boast of having, why are women so foolish as to be proud of weakness, which is a defect? Rousseau has provided them with a plausible excuse that could only have occurred to a man whose imagination had been allowed to run wild in search for ways of making impressions of the senses seem more refined, to give him a pretext for yielding to a natural appetite, while still maintaining a romantic sort of modesty that gratifies his pride and his libertinism. Women, deluded by these sentiments, sometimes boast of their weakness, cunningly obtaining power by playing on the weakness of men, and coming to have, like Turkish generals, more real power than their masters. But this involves sacrificing virtue to temporary gratifications, and sacrificing a life worthy of respect to the triumph of an hour. Women, as well as despots, may now have more power than they would have if the world, divided and subdivided into kingdoms and families, was governed by laws deduced from the exercise of reason. But in obtaining it, to carry on the comparison between them and despots, their character is degraded, and licentiousness spread through the whole aggregate of society. So I will venture to assert that until women are more rationally educated, the progress of human virtue and improvement in knowledge will certainly meet continual obstacles. If you accept that woman was not created merely to gratify the appetite of man, to be the upper servant who provides his meals and takes care of his linen, then you ought to grant also that mothers or fathers who are serious about the education of females should have as their first concern, if not to strengthen the body, at least not to destroy the girl's physical constitution by mistaken notions of beauty and female excellence. And girls should never be allowed to absorb the pernicious notion that some chemical process of reasoning can turn a defect into an excellence. On this matter, I am happy to find that the author of one of the most instructive books our country has produced for children, Thomas Day's Sandford and Merton, thinks as I do. In that book, a respectable old man gives the following sensible account of how he went about educating his daughter Celine. "I try to give to both her mind and her body a degree of vigour that is seldom found in the female sex. As soon as she was strong enough to be capable of light work in the garden and around the farm, I employed her as my constant companion. Celine soon became dexterous in all these rustic jobs, which gave me equal amounts of pleasure and admiration. If women are in general feeble in body and mind, that arises less from nature than from education. We encourage a bad slackness and inactivity, which we falsely call delicacy. Instead of hardening their minds by the severer principles of reason and philosophy, we train them in useless arts that lead only to vanity and sensuality. In most of the countries I have visited, they are taught nothing of a higher nature than a few modulations of the voice or useless postures of the body. Their time is taken in idleness or trifles, and trifles become the only pursuits capable of interesting them. We seem to forget that our own domestic comforts and the education of our children must depend on the qualities of the female sex. And what comforts or education can we expect from a race of beings who are corrupted from their infancy and know nothing of the duties of life? The only arts cultivated by women in most of the polished nations I have seen were touching a musical instrument with useless skill, exhibiting their natural or artificial graces to the eyes of idle and debauched young men, and wasting their husbands' wealth in riotous and unnecessary expenses. And the consequences are always just what you would expect to come from such polluted sources: private misery and public servitude. Celine's education was regulated by different views, and conducted on severer principles, if you can call severe something that opens the mind to a sense of moral and religious duties, and arms it most effectively against the inevitable evils of life." That ends my quotation from Thomas Day. Suppose it were proved that woman is naturally weaker than man. How does it follow that it is natural for her to try to become even weaker than nature intended her to be? Arguments of this sort are an insult to common sense, and have a whiff of passion about them. I hope that in this enlightened age, the divine right of husbands, like the divine right of kings, can be challenged without danger to the challenger. And although conviction may not silence many boisterous disputants, still, when any prevailing prejudice is attacked, the wise will think about it, and leave thoughtless and noisy scolding to the narrow-minded. A mother who wants to give her daughter true dignity of character must ignore the sneers of ignorance, and proceed on a plan diametrically opposite to the one Rousseau has recommended, with all the deluding charms of eloquence and philosophical trickery. his eloquence makes absurdities plausible. And when his dogmatic conclusions are considered by people who aren't able to refute them, they produce puzzlement, but no conviction. Throughout the whole animal kingdom, every young creature requires almost continual exercise, and the infancy of children should similarly be spent in harmless play that exercises the feet and hands without requiring very precise direction from the head or the constant attention of a governess. In fact, the care necessary for self-preservation is the first natural exercise of the understanding, as inventive little pastimes stretch the imagination. But these wise designs of nature are counteracted by mistaken fondness or blind zeal. The child, in particular a girl, is not left for a moment to its own direction, and is thus made dependent, and dependence is called natural. To preserve personal beauty, woman's glory, the girl's limbs and faculties are cramped with worse than Chinese bands, and the sedentary life they are condemned to live while boys play in the open air weakens their muscles and slackens their nerves. Rousseau's remarks that girls are naturally, i.e. from birth and independent of education, fond of dolls, dressing, and talking, have since been echoed by many writers, and are too puerile to merit a serious refutation. If a girl is condemned to sit for hours listening to the idle chat of weak governesses, or to be present at her mother's toilet, it is indeed very natural for her to try to join the conversation, and to imitate her mother or aunts, and to amuse herself by adorning her lifeless doll, as they amuse themselves in dressing her, poor innocent babe. Men of the greatest abilities have seldom been strong enough to rise above the surrounding atmosphere. And if the page of genius has always been blurred by the prejudices of the times, some allowance should be made for the members of a sex who, like kings, always see things through a false medium. Thus, we can easily explain women's conspicuous fondness for dress, without supposing it to come from a desire to please the members of the sex on which they are dependent. In short, the supposition that a girl is naturally a coquette, and her behaviour expresses a desire connected with nature's impulse to propagate the species, even before an improper education has, by heating the imagination, created the desire prematurely, is absurd. It's so unphilosophical that such an intelligent observer as Rousseau wouldn't have adopted it if he hadn't been accustomed to pushing his desire for uniqueness ahead of reason, and pushing a favourite paradox ahead of truth. To give a sexual slant to mind in this way was not very consistent with the principles of a man who argued so warmly and so well for the immortality of the soul. But truth is a weak barrier when it stands in the way of an hypothesis. Rousseau respected virtue. He almost adored it. And yet he allowed himself to love with sensual fondness. His imagination constantly prepared combustible fuel for his combustible senses. But, in order to reconcile his other views with his respect for self-denial, fortitude, and those heroic virtues that a mind like his could not coolly admire, he tries to invert the law of nature, and launches a doctrine that is pregnant with harm and derogatory to the character of God. He tells stories aiming to show that girls are naturally attentive to their physical appearance. The stories are ridiculous, beneath contempt. I have probably had more opportunity to observe girls in their infancy than J.J. Rousseau has. I can recollect my own feelings, and I have looked steadily around me, and far from sharing his view about the first dawn of the female character, I will venture to say that a girl whose spirits haven't been damped by inactivity, and whose innocence hasn't been tainted by false shame, will always be a romp, and the doll will never interest her unless confinement allows her no alternative. Girls and boys would play harmlessly together if the difference between the sexes hadn't been drilled into them long before nature makes any difference. Among the women I have known, this is a matter of plain objective fact. the ones who have acted like rational creatures, or shown some vigour of intellect, are ones who had this kind of freedom in their youth, or, in the language of some of the elegant experts on their fair sex, had been allowed to run wild. The evils that flow from inattention to bodily health during infancy and youth extend further than is supposed. Dependence of body naturally produces dependence of mind. And how can someone be a good wife or mother if most of her time is spent guarding against or enduring sickness? And it can't be expected that a woman will resolutely try to strengthen her constitution, abstaining from indulgences that would harm her health, if her motives of action were, at an early age, entangled with artificial notions of beauty and false descriptions of sensibility. Most men sometimes have to put up with bodily troubles, and occasionally to go out into bad weather. But genteel women are, literally speaking, slaves to their bodies, and they glory in their subjection. Women are in this deplorable state everywhere, because truth is hidden from them so as to preserve their innocence, the polite name for ignorance, and they are made to take on an artificial character before their faculties have acquired any strength. Taught from their infancy that beauty is woman's sceptre, the mind shapes itself to the body, and roaming around in its gilt cage, it only seeks to adorn its prison. Men have various employments and pursuits that engage their attention and help to shape their developing minds. But women, confined to one pursuit, and having their thoughts constantly directed to the most insignificant part of themselves, seldom extend their view beyond the triumph of the hour. But if their understanding were emancipated from the slavery to which the pride and sensuality of man and their short-sighted desire has subjected them, we would probably read of their weaknesses with surprise. Let me pursue the argument a little further. If there were an evil being who, in the allegorical language of Scripture, went about seeking whom he should devour, he could not more effectively degrade the human character than by giving a man absolute power. This argument branches off in various directions. Birth, riches, and every intrinsic advantage that raise a man above his fellows, without any mental exertion, really sink him below them. In proportion to his weakness, he is manipulated by designing men until the bloated monster loses all traces of humanity, and tribes of men like flocks of sheep quietly follow such a leader. That is a blunder that can only be explained by narrowness of understanding and a desire for present enjoyment. If men are educated in slavish dependence and weakened by luxury and sloth, who will stand up and assert the rights of man, or claim the privilege of moral beings who should have only one road to excellence? Slavery to monarchs and ministers, whose deadly grasp stops the progress of the human mind, is not yet abolished, and won't be for a long time. Let not men, then, in the pride of power, use the same arguments that tyrannical kings and venal ministers have used, and fallaciously assert that woman ought to be subjected because she has always been so. When man is governed by reasonable laws, and enjoying his natural freedom, let him then despise woman if she does not share it with him. But until that glorious period arrives in holding forth about the folly of the female sex, let him not overlook his own. It is evident that when women obtain power by unjust means, they lose the rank appropriate to their having reason, and become either abject slaves or capricious tyrants. In acquiring power, they lose all simplicity, all dignity of mind, and act as we see men act when they have been exalted by the same wrong means. End of first part of chapter 3.